So all my power tools are with the cord and stuff, and now they have lead batteries. They have gel batteries, like old gel batteries. I had that for the motorcycle, and for the car, I use an AGM battery for the car. So that's about it. That's about it for today, and I'll pass it over to you. Back to you, Dick.
To R.Y. Mr. R.Y., that's all we heard. Give us your comment, sir. Full call letters and name, and then your comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hello, K2RIW, this is KG2RY, name is David. Fine business. I just figured out that a D battery, the alkaline D battery, is 12,000 milliamp hours, so it's like 12 amp hours. So if you take 9 of those D batteries and put them into a container that connects in series, it's in series, I think you would say in series, right? Then you get 13.5 volts at 12 amp hours. Would that basically power up a low-powered HF rig or a UHF radio? Go ahead.
I think the answer is yes, a slightly expensive approach. And the ones you're talking about, I'm fairly sure, are not rechargeable batteries. But could you get 12 ampere hours out of that and power the rig? There's sort of a yes to that. One of the things you got to worry about with almost all batteries is that as they reach the end of life and the voltage starts dropping, there's many a rig where we're told it needs 12 volts input, and we set our power supply to 13.8. because an automobile that's running with its alternator running is producing something like 13.8 volts. And a number of those rigs, when you go down to 12.0 or 11.99, the rig starts misbehaving. Quite a few of them do that. So would you get the full 12 ampere hours out of that without going below 12 volts is an interesting question. And anybody's got any further comments on this one? K2RIW, the tech man.
Most rigs will shut off with that 11.9, 11.8 volts.
Yeah, I've seen a sideband rig will really start sounding ratty at around 11.9. So we call it 12 volts. It really means 13.7. Otherwise, some of your internal regulators start dropping out. So that's something to worry about. I guess you could put one extra cell in there to make sure that you don't drop below 12 volts is one possible approach. Or you can use some fancy electronics. There are kinds of electronics where it's an alternator-like system, a power supply voltage regulator, where you give it anything from, let me pick a number, 4 to 20 volts, and it'll continuously spit out exactly 13.8. It's a buck boost type voltage regulator. There are kinds of electronics you can buy that'll do that. Let's go over to Joe because he's waiting very patiently. W2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead.
Repeater, timeout.
You've got it, Joe, RYY.
Hey, good evening, W2RYY. I just wonder if anybody there, you or anybody else ever analyze a speaker by using a microphone and an oscilloscope. But sometimes you may listen to a speaker, especially if you face a speaker, being hooked to a radio, and that's under test. You may say the thing sounds either tinny or, you know, maybe a little distorted or something like that, or something. I'm just wondering really what your ears are hearing when you hear that, if you can actually look at that, if you used a calibrated signal generator, putting in a single sine wave and varying the frequency up and down through that, the audio spectrum, to actually see something actually change, where you can use something of what the microphone would pick up of the speaker being, reproducing the sound that you're sending into it. Back to you.
Yeah, the question you're asking, Joe, I think it's got kind of a yes and a no answer to it. A loudspeaker will give you very different performance depending on what kind of an enclosure you put it in. A microphone, all microphones have got some kind of a personality to them. To buy a truly flat microphone, you can go to various companies that make laboratory-rated flat microphones. by which you can rate the acoustics of a room or the quality of a loudspeaker plus its enclosure, but these are very expensive items. So he takes a combination of various loudspeakers in various enclosures, mounted in various rooms where the liveliness of the room makes a difference and where the loudspeaker in the room makes a difference. Then you put a microphone in front of it, and the microphone itself has got personality, which may not be traceable to the bureau. So, yes, we amateurs could get a rough test and a comparison by doing that with our favorite microphone, but to do it in a way that's traceable to the bureau, in an anechoic chamber with a flat rated microphone. I can't think of the name of the company that makes these things. B&K, I think it is. There are companies that make laboratory grade microphones for doing that kind of work, and my goodness, are they pricey. I'm going to pass it back to you, Joe, but drag your feet, because I guarantee Eric has got some. Let me turn it over to Eric. Eric, when it comes to flatness of sound reproducing equipment, I'll bet you there's a lot of art and science that goes into that. KE2EJ for the broadcast industry. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Well, there's a couple of companies that are pretty much a gold standard for reference microphones, and that's Neumann and Sennheiser. And they're not cheap. And they also make them as part of a sweep system, where essentially you inject big noise into a room and you can measure its response. Remember, speakers are subjective. It's really in the... it's sort of like it's in the eye of the beholder, rather than the listener. You can have two speakers that sweep out flat, but they have, to a human being, they have different characteristics because of the way the spider mount is around the magnet, because of the cone material itself. When you're doing a sweep, you're using a single frequency in your whip war. Whether or not it's flat or it's got little ripples in it, it's really more complicated than that. The actual reference microphone, when it is up, they're actually adjusted and sweeped in an enclosed environment. You can think of like your antenna anechoic chamber. There's something similar to that in terms of the measurement when they created the microphone was based on air pressure. So a very precise mechanical environment was created for making the reference microphone. But then again, you know, in the real world, this whole thing becomes very subjective. Reflections in the room, you get SWR off the wall, you get all kinds of effects, especially when you're trying to set up a room. If you take Lincoln Center, for example, the panels on the ceiling and the wall actually change their physical positions based upon the type of performance that they're actually creating. So it's an interesting world. K2IW, K2J.
So if I was a presenter in that environment, my acoustic engineer might tell the owner of the facility, I want you to put these kind of panels up for this particular performance, and I want you to aim them this particular way. Does that kind of an event actually take place, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Believe it or not, Lincoln Center, for example, has a resident audio guy. He's a friend of mine. Actually, he's very well known in the industry. He actually, in conjunction with the performers, create the performance environment for the opera, for a concert, for the symphony. And the different theaters at Lincoln Center are so equipped to be able to accommodate the type of performances that they're creating. So, in essence, yes, you can say to him that you're going to do this particular type of thing. This is the kind of sound that you want to create. And if you're just a single talking head, it'll be one setup. If it's an orchestra, which has got, you know, 200 people on the stage, it'll be a completely different setup. So, yes, and actually they don't have to bring them in. The stuff is there permanently mounted, and it can do a whole lot of amazing things.
As I see it, Joe, sound ain't simple. My goodness. So, I think you can make relative measurements in the methods that you are advocating. But to get a measurement traceable to the Bureau so that you could tell a loudspeaker manufacturer, hey, I bought your expensive loudspeaker model so-and-so, and the serial number 14 that I received, it has this glitch in it, and this is the method by which I tested it, and I want to return it and get a replacement. That's a tough one. They're going to give you flack on your and my method of measurement in our environment. W-E-2-R-Y-Y.
Let me throw you something at you, Dick.
Go right ahead, Eric.
If you're buying a high-end speaker, like a Genwex, a voice in a theater or something like that, you will actually get from the manufacturer a graph which has a sweep of its reproduction in a neutral environment. And based on that, and if you do a sweep of your room, making those measurements, it will come somewhat close to what you see the manufacturer has created. If you find it radically different, then you know you've got a problem. You can bring the manufacturer, especially if you're talking about speakers that are in the thousands of dollars, they will actually come and help you correct your problem. So, it's a different world than the consumer world. So, get to RWK to the guy.
Too well.
Go right ahead, Bernie.
I guess back to Joe's original question, is he looking at something he can do in his shack for having the best performance speaker for him? Or, you know, we've kind of gone off onto the high end of audio tuning, etc. I guess the question back to Joe is, do you want to do this for the best sounding speaker on your bench, or are you looking at music halls, etc.?
You've got it, Joe. Wait for the beeps.
No, the question was basically meant for a communications type speaker. In other words, say something installed in a radio. I'll give you more specifically, Dick, an experience I found is sometimes I work on different mobile radios from time to time, and sometimes you get a radio that has a speaker that has the paper slightly dried out, and the thing will give you one type of sound. Maybe it sounds kind of tinny, it doesn't reproduce the low end quite as easily as it should. That's the kind of thing I was really talking about more than anything else, not buying, spending a tremendous amount of money and buying something for, high-end audio, things like that. Talk about more or less a communication type of speaker assembly, and if you look at that with a decent microphone on an oscilloscope, really what would you sort of see in that kind of a fact? That's sort of what I was kind of steering with this type of question. Back to you.
Sounds like Eric's got some further information. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay, a couple things you got to understand first. A communication speaker is designed to emphasize the sibilant portions of speech and the low end of the vocal cords. So they're not designed to be terribly flat. That's the first thing. Second thing you can do is you can sweep speakers and determine whether the spider is got broken legged on a spider, or if your cones dried out, or the edges of the cones are losing their glue into the mount, and it gives you all sorts of really, for lack of a better way of saying it, really crappy response. People who are used to working with that stuff, and there are folks out there that do that, can instantly identify what's wrong with the speaker, its cone, or even with a scope, you can identify the fact that the voice coil rubbing against the magnet, or the spider has got a broken leg, or you've got a hole in the cone, which gives you a very flappy kind of sound. So usually people who are good at that, they get that way through experience.
Bye. I wonder if that's helpful, Joe. By the way, I have used lots of radio anechoic chambers. Great big chambers that have got these pyramid-shaped absorbing objects in the walls that have got carbon granules buried into them. And it turns out that a radio anechoic chamber are slightly similar. And when you're inside one of these radio anechoic chambers, my goodness, is it quiet. To be? You wanted to say something on that one, Bernie? Go ahead, Bernie.
But my
that you set up a small set of test protocol. You're not going to be able to get measurements based against the standard, but you can get measurements between two and see what the difference is in the two. That if you can find a way to inject pink noise into the speaker and then measure that output with a microphone, and if you have a digital oscilloscope, you can then actually have it do the Fourier series and show you pressure at frequency. And so what you're looking for, and if you don't have a digital scope that can do that, there's probably some very inexpensive, if not free, PC program that will let you take the input of the mic input on a PC and display it with power in the vertical and frequency in the horizontal. And that would let you effectively snapshot two different speakers against each other and see what that difference is in sound, which to me, it appears that that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, I have a problem with that.
Go ahead, Eric.
What Bernie is saying is absolutely correct in terms of creating a profile, but when it comes down to finding what's wrong with a specific speaker, pink noise is a problem. You actually have to use a sweep generator, which is a single frequency at any given point in time. And from that, you can identify what the issues are. Pink noise is every little bit of frequency in the audio spectrum all simultaneously, which leads to other kinds of things where you can't actually find a particular issue. Whereas if you've got a rubbing voice coil, you won't be able to see the actual effect if you're looking at it on a scope. So, yes, I agree with Bernie in terms of creating a profile in a speaker, but it doesn't allow you to isolate a given problem, let's say.
I think I see what you're saying, Eric. I have had a rubbing coil on a loudspeaker, and at very low volumes, it sounds terrible. At very high volumes, the high volume gives you a lot of push to that coil, and it almost overcomes the fact that it's rubbing, and it starts sounding reasonably good. So therefore, pink noise giving you a total amount of energy into a loudspeaker could slightly override a rubbing coil, which at normal speech volumes could be giving you some grief. So I like the idea of a sweeping single tone. W-H-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the tech net. You got it, Joe.
I have no other questions on this particular subject. W-H-2-R-Y-Y.
If I know you, Joe, you're going to be looking into it further. And as you find out various things, please come back and tell us what you find. Next person on our list was George, KD2, FIU. What would you like to talk about tonight, George? K2RIW in the tech net. Oh, wait a minute, stop. Stand by. Steve came before George. KC2MDP. Steve, sorry, we almost skipped you. K2RIW in the tech net. You better, Steve.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. How am I making it into the machine?
You sound very good. You're 95% audio, 5% hit.
Creating some sort of interference. Back to you.
In a number of automobiles, the light-emitting diodes are operating at some kind of a pulse rate. You wave your hand in front of your face while looking at those lights, and you get a stroboscopic effect. So let's see. It sounds like Eric has had possibly a solution or a suggestion once he knows more about the problem. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Eric.
No, I'm waiting for that. Yeah, echo, echo, ILP. You can probably hear me. I've run into a number of folks who have similar problems. And the LED lights, that's why I said you need more information, whether it was incandescent or LEDs. The LED lights actually operate as PWM, as you mentioned, and there is a whole electronic board that's usually associated with it, mounted in the floorboard or on the firewall. Some of them, like the ones that I've seen that are in the Hyundais, in a plastic case. They make all sorts of noise. You take a spectrum analyzer and you see all sorts of noise coming out of it. The Toyotas and that stuff are in the metal case. They don't make a peep. So, and then of course you've got the cables that run to the lights. on Bay Radio 2, so that's a prep one. KTLIW, K2J.
So, of the people listening here tonight, I think we don't know anyone who has run into the problem of the turn signals making electromagnetic interference into the 2-meter and 440 radios where they know of a solution. I think it's going to be a tough one. If your particular car happens to have a plastic case around that assembly, for you to now properly shield it, to properly bypass it, so that you stop all of that noise, I think it's going to be very difficult to get to it, to do the work. On top of that, my prediction is, and I hope I'm wrong, is that after you put some heroic effort into this, you're going to knock it down some number of decibels. You'll make it 10 dB quieter. But to make it thoroughly quiet, I think it's going to be tough. And so you might have to live with a noisy turn signal when you're on 2-meter radio, which, of course, makes you a more dangerous driver. It means now, at times when you should be using the turn signal because you're listening to a vital conversation of somebody, you're not going to be using the turn signal. I hope I'm wrong, but I think this is a tough one, Steve. KC2MTP, K2IW in the TechNet. Drag your feet in case somebody has a solution. You got it, Steve.
Also, make sure that you're connected to the battery and not the cigarette lighter port.
Yeah, if the radio is getting a cleaner B-plus voltage, that could help an awful lot. So maybe that's what Steve was asking us. Should he put the EMI devices on the 12-volt lead into the battery, into the radio? The way you can run this test, Steve, is to take your radio and run it on a thoroughly independent power supply, different from the car. In other words, you bring the equivalent of a car battery into your car and plug your radio into it while the car is running with its turn signal. So, by way of divide...
Repeater, timeout.
By way of divide and conquer, you may be able to find out, is the majority of the noise coming in your antenna, coming in the shield of your antenna, coming in the 12-volt lead going into your radio. The nice situation would be if it's coming into the 12-volt lead of the radio, now you stand a chance. I'm worried that it's really being radiated throughout the whole wiring of the car itself. And those tail light wiring, it's a very long wire from the firewall all the way back to the stern of the automobile. KC2MTP, K2IW in the TechNet.
We gotta wait for it to drop. Yes, very good suggestion, Dick. I do have one of those jump start 12-volt things. I can isolate the radio from the battery, give that a shot. At least it's on a turn signal. If it was on a tail light, so I'd be totally messed up. Back to you, Dick. Thank you.
Steve, what brand of automobile are we talking about?
It's a Ford Explorer.
I got an answer for you there.
Go right ahead. Whoever you are, start up with your name, call letters, and go ahead with your answer there.
That's me, Dick. The Explorer has a couple of problems, actually. One, most people don't realize, it's got an electric fuel pump. They've tried for many years to make them damn things quiet, so it adds a certain noise level to it. I have a Ford Escape, and it's a hybrid, and I can't hear 5-2 because it just puts out a continual birdie there. Ford has a grounding kit for the fuel pump. They also have a grounding kit for the block, and they also have a grounding kit for the electronics. Now, my car's got like 16 little microprocessors in it, plus they've got the motor drivers, which are big, hefty switching transistors. But Ford is very much on RFI. If you talk to a dealer, they won't know what the heck you're talking about. You actually have to call a factory, and they will in turn work with your dealer and help you to eliminate the RFI. They're a company that's very conscious of it. I've been to the factory with this thing, and we've actually modified it. We've taken it from...
having a noise figure on your S meter of something like S8 or S9 down to like S2 or S3. I can't really operate HF in this car unless it's on 40 meters, which is, for some reason it's quiet. I go to 20, it's just a noise bag. So Ford's a good company about that. K2IWK, Tuesday.
And ICSD, that sounds very encouraging. If you get right to the right Ford people in your local dealer, might not quite know what you're talking about. KC2MCP, KTLIW, good luck with that project. I'm back to you, Steve.
Very good, Dick. Thank you, Eric. Yes, all good suggestions. I will, just for experiment's sake, I will, when I get a chance, I'm going to isolate the radio from the car's electrical system and see what happens.
The actual antenna on your vehicle is mounted in which portion of the vehicle, Steve? Does the antenna happen to be close to the taillight? Over to you, Steve.
As a matter of fact, it is, Dick. I was thinking the same thing. It is towards the back, yes.
Then another experiment would be to take a mag mount and put the mag mount on various portions of the car while measuring up turn signal noise. That could give you some hints where if you do the combination of isolating the 12 volts going into the radio and putting the antenna in the right spot, that combined maybe with working with Ford, altogether I think you're going to get a solution. Looks like you've got the, we've given you an awful lot of homework there, Steve. It's going to take you a while to come back with all of these answers. Over to you, K2RIW.
K2FIU comment.
Yeah, I need something to do on these dark, cold nights. Back to you.
K2FIU comment.
George is the next guy on our list. KD2FIU. By the way, each time you key the microphone, George, the first few seconds doesn't come through. We hear nothing but the FIU. So, both your comment and your question. You've got the floor, George. Kilo Delta 2, FIU, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. This is George, KD2FIU. Listening to this, I would ask the auto manufacturer what they're doing to not get it into the lower portion of VHF, that being the 88 through 108 megahertz portion. Whether it's in the radio, whether it's anything additional in line to that radio, meaning to your FM broadcast radio. There's got to be some technical answer that they've done to modify their radios or the inline antenna reception to those radios. KD2FIU.
Yeah, further good information there, George. George, now you had a real question that you signed in with, so go right ahead with your question, George.
No, Dick. I was calling in with comment about the vertical antennas that require no ground radial system, and how the antenna is an off-center balanced, off-center fed dipole, as it was. That's what I was calling in earlier. I did have my time on that. Thank you, KD2FIU.
I thank you for your
comment.
I thank you for your contribution, George. And now Rich is going to tell us the real story. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra. K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
I was going to, one comment is just that a lot of the later model 2 meter 440 radios that also have an extremely wide front end where they'll pick up all other bands as well as the 144 and 440 megahertz bands. They tend to receive all sorts of stuff and have very little rejection. But one thing that might help them, which you had already mentioned, is try moving the antenna. But if he has a 2 meter HT, or if he can borrow a 2 meter HT from somebody, and if he can get the noise on that, he might be able to determine is the interference strong coming from the dash, is it stronger coming from the back end of the car. if he can locate that the module that Eric was talking about that controls those lights, maybe wrapping that in foil or something might help shield it as well. But I would use an AFT to try to track down just where in the car it's coming from.
Yeah, that's an excellent suggestion, Rich. A handy talkie with a rubber duck antenna as a sniffer, and you walk it around toward the taillight, with and without the trunk open. Walk it along the sides of the car, get inside the car, hold it near the firewall, open up the hood of the car, hold it near the firewall on the engine side, and so on. Hold it near the cigarette lighter. A handy talkie, while listening to a known FM signal, so to speak, or a 450 signal, the handy talkie as a sniffer, that's even better than the mag mount. That's a beauty. I'm surprised we didn't think of that. Why didn't we think of that one sooner, Rich? I'm pretty sure we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in, who said he's got a question. So I think it's time we go over to the mailbag. KC2WGB. And what kind of response have we had on Echo Link and IRLP and the chat room? KC2WGB, K2IW. You got it, Rich. You got it, John.
Got one last thing for you, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
This relates back to the gentleman talking about the FM radios in the car. If you're tuned where there is no station and you listen to it, and you turn the ignition on and off, generally we'll hear the noise floor of the FM radio raised by X amount. More and more, all our vehicles have microprocessors in them, various different clocks running at various different rates. They also use something called a CAN bus, which is a differential bus, that provides data, sort of like the master data flow for the car. And then they have something called a WIN bus, which is basically a single wire bus with radios like you wouldn't believe, and that's things are generally used for window control, controls on the steering wheel, things of that nature. And it's also part of the same system that runs the blinking lights and stuff like that. So more and more RF-wise, we are making more and more pollution. Although the manufacturers try to keep it to a minimum, but it's getting worse and worse as the technology improves. So, TRIWK to the guy.
Yeah, I've got two questions for you, Eric. I think most of the modern 88 to 108 megacycle FM broadcast radios that are in our automobiles, I don't know if you can tune them between stations because they're synthesized, and also they got a squelch circuit which cuts off the audio if there isn't a station there. So to listen to the noise between stations with a modern day radio could be a little bit difficult. That's question number one. And the last I knew, your hybrid automobile needed air conditioning to be operational in order to keep the battery that runs your car cool. I wonder how elaborate that air conditioning repair was. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. The compressor had to get replaced. The compressor actually wasn't bad. It was a clutch assembly on the compressor, but since it was cheaper to buy the whole darn thing, that's what we did. After that got replaced, and while we were at it, we replaced the water pump because we saw that had a little bit of leakiness to it, so we did that at the same time. And this time I actually didn't do it myself. Somebody else was very gracious and did it for us, which was a lot easier because I would have been on my back for 2 days, so that was cool. And the battery's now very happy ever since we did that. It's getting its proper air conditioning. The temperature runs down. I actually can monitor the CAN bus. You can actually read the battery temperature and a whole lot of other stuff. But, you know, when Ford made the car, they made it to look like any other car. But if you're smart and you've got the right adapter, you can plug in and see what's actually going on. And since I made the trip to the factory, I was able to get a copy of the software that does that. So that was really cool. K2RIWK2J.
That's awful nice. In other words, your hybrid automobile, by way of the software you now own, has a whole lot of built-in test functions, is what I think you're hearing. Well, I think I'm hearing you, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, all cars have an OBD2 connector, which is a
now they actually use it for inspection because they no longer stick a thing into the tailpipe. They actually read what the computer is saying. But the software that I got doesn't actually plug into the OBD connector. There's a number of CAN ports that you can actually plug into. And that runs with special software. So it's not available through the OBD connector, the stuff that I was looking at. Most of the engine stuff is available through that OBD connector, which, you know, people normally use to fix their vehicles, but every manufacturer has their quote-unquote proprietary systems. It's unique to their own, so I was just fortunate enough that I was befriended one of their engineers to try to hire me while I was there, and, you know, I managed to finagle it out of them, so I was lucky at that point.
That automobile of yours is an engineer's tweaking paradise. Oh boy, you could have fun with that. Reminds me of the engineering friend I had in 1970 I worked with, who built himself with his own hands an A-frame house in Eshroken, and he installed a heat pump, and the heat pumps in 1970 were fairly new, and boy, he had a lot of fun as an engineer tweaking that over the years. Okay, John, what was the mailbag like? What was Echo Link like? What was chat room like? And what kind of questions are they going to stump us with this weekend? KC2WGB with the mailbag and other things. K2RIW the TechNet. You've got it, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Paul, everyone on the net. Yeah, let's see. We've got between 8 and 9 an Echo Link, and the chat room is quiet. And usually is. All right. Let me see. Let me go on to my first one here. I'll let it drop. Okay, this ham wants to know, how do you go about sending a DC voltage up the actual coaxial cable to the antenna, which is the feed for the antenna, and operate a device up there without interfering with the transmission signal? How do they do that? Maybe you could fill them in on some of that information, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
We're choking. Yeah, there's many an amateur that's running a low noise preamplifier up at the antenna. Some of us are running a complete transceiver up at the antenna. In other words, when I'm on 10 gigahertz, I ship 144 meg single sideband up the coax cable, and that goes into a box that's sitting behind the 2-foot dish that converts 144 megs. The transverter converts it up to 10.368 gigahertz, single sideband, and therefore my actual feed line at 10 gigs is only a few inches long, whereas if I really ran a piece of waveguide up the 100 feet of tower, plus another 20 feet in the house, I'd be getting an awful lot of loss on both transmit and receive. So, in the case of coax cable, you can put not only DC voltage. There are people who put pulsating positive voltage, pulsating negative voltage, RF voltage, more than one RF voltage. The coax cable, when properly fed, can support a whole lot of crazy digital, analog, and whatever signals. Let me drop. One way to do it would be to install a T connector at the shack end of the cable. The fake through portion of the T connector is the RF energy being fed through. The T port off to one side touches a carefully made RF choke. Sometimes that RF choke is made in a spiral, in a conic spiral-like structure. There are ways of making an RF choke that's extremely broadband over multiple octaves. That RF choke allows you to put B plus voltages or any other kind of voltage, plus and minus AC voltages, onto the center conductor of the coax, and has essentially no effect on the RF energy. The RF won't go into that RF choke, into that T connector third port. You got to worry a little bit about, let me drop. You got to worry about the fact that many an antenna has a built-in DC short circuit within the antenna, the equivalent of an RF choke from the center conductor to ground, by the way the antenna is constructed. So you might have to put a isolating capacitor at the antenna. So the isolating capacitor by using devices like that, you can put, I do remember putting positive voltage on my coax cable. It would flip some of the relays in one direction. Negative voltage on the coax cable would flip some other relays. These were latching relays, magnetically latching relays. I had a whole bunch of relays in the phasing harness of my array of 16 Yagis. For people who have seen my red QSL card with me standing in the middle of this antenna, the antenna is 16 Yagis. Let me drop it. 16 19-element Yagis on 432, total of 304 elements. The antenna was 16 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep. This cube of antennas mounted to the top of the tower, and it all rotated around the tower. By feeding various voltages up that coax cable, I could flip some of those magnetic latching relays such that I could now decide to feed all 16 Yagis at once, feed one vertical column of four Yagis, or feed one single Yagi at the top of the array. That was a zoom control. Each one of those steps would be 6 dB of change in gain, and I went from a 5.5 degree horizontal vertical beamwidth to a 25 degree horizontal and 5 degree vertical beamwidth. That's one vertical column versus a 25 by 25 when I fed one single Yagi. The advantage of doing that zoom control, is that quite often with a large number of Yagis, you've got side lobes all over the place, and you can be rotating the antenna mechanically trying to peek up on somebody. Let me drop it. And you didn't know it, but you lined this guy a single sideband signal. You lined him up into one of the side lobes instead of the main lobe. By going to the broader antenna patterns, step number one or step number two, swish the antenna until he's in the peak of the broad beam, then go to the fine beam, high gain mode, all 16 Yagis, and do final peaking. Now you knew he's really in the main lobe, not in one of the side lobes. So I did that by feeding voltages up the coax cable, and that coax cable was the same one that took the 432 sideband signal to the antennas. So RF chokes and capacitive coupling, the coax cable doesn't know the difference, if you know what I mean, whether you're putting DC voltages on it or RF voltages on it. It behaves very well in all of those cases. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, we call them biases, and I'll give you a real-world example that everybody can understand.
Go right ahead, Eric. Wait for the beeps and give us that info.
Anybody that has a direct TV receiver or a satellite receiver, dish network, you have to feed 18 volts to the LNB in order to make it work. And what they essentially do is exactly what you described. We call it a bias. It's built into the receiver itself, and up at the antenna end, there is something called a DC block, which is basically a capacitor. They suck off the DC through another choke at the LNB. They insert the DC at the receiver through another choke, and the DC goes up, and that powers the LNB. Now, to change the polarization, what they do is they inject an audio signal at what frequency is it? I think there's one at 22 kilohertz and another one at 12 kilohertz, and that gets fed up. That actually passes through the choke. Because it's not a very high frequency, and that's what you use every day when you watch television. And we also use them in some of our microwave systems and a few other things. We've got a studio where we actually have a coax that runs between it, and all the control signals, which is in a digital form, also run up the coax. So there you go. K2RIW, K2RIW.
KBZ with the comments.
I'll recognize. Get to you in a second, Hal. The low noise block converter that I owned, Eric, needed 12 volts to run the low noise amplifier. 12 volts went into a regulator, regulated the sound to something like 5 volts. Actually, 5 volts went to the low noise gas fed transistors. They fed 12 volts up for one polarity, 18 volts up for the other polarity. In other words, just changing the magnitude of the voltage, the logic circuit.
Repeater, timeout.
The logic circuit in the low noise block converter in the one that I own could sense the difference between 12 volts, which maybe was horizontal polarization, and 18 volts, which is vertical polarization. So changing the magnitude of the voltage would do the switching. As I said, you did it by changing tones in there. So I wonder if you've ever heard of that one, Eric, of where 12 versus 18 volts was a popular design at one time. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. You're talking about the Chaparral Polarotor, and that's how that worked. The thing with the DSS, the direct-to-home satellite, which is KA and KU band, they don't actually twist, you know, they don't give you the ability to twist the polarization simply because it's looking at fixed satellites. You don't have to change it because you're not looking at different points in the sky, but they use the audio tones to switch between the horizontal and vertical polarization of a particular satellite, and they also use it to switch between KU and KA in its output. And the new ones, which are using both KA and KU band, there's, I think, three different frequencies that they use, and they just feed a constant 18 volt. The C-band stuff that you're talking about, you had a polarotor, so it wasn't, yeah, let's see, it was, you would feed 12 volts to H and 18 volts to V, and then you had the ability to adjust the actual polarization. Am I not correct?
On C-band, where the satellites were linear polarized, yes, but on KU band, I believe there was a brand of low noise block. Let me drop it. Yeah, something is competing with us.
Somebody on Echo was, I think. Now, let me look.
Yeah, there was a low noise block down converter for KU band reception where one voltage, like 12 volts, gave you clockwise circular polarization, and 18 volts gave you counterclockwise circular polarization. The circular polarized...
Are you looking at Intelsat?
I thought the KU band downlink for DirecTV was circular polarized. I might be wrong on that one.
Yeah, no, it is. For DirecTV, it's fixed, so... no, I'm talking about, you know, in the old days, like the non-direct-to-home satellites, you know, 15-watt transponders as opposed to 150-watt transponders. They're linear.
I do remember seeing a brand of KU band block down converter where the feed horn assembly in the low noise block converter, low noise amplifier, contained two separate probes at right angles with a septum halfway between the two. One of the probes would receive clockwise, one of the probes will receive counterclockwise. So depending on whether you're looking at an odd or an even numbered transponder, you either listen to clockwise or counterclockwise CP in the downlink. There was a brand that did that with 12 and 18 volts going up the 2 gig downlink cable. Over to you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW.
Yeah, either you were looking at a direct-to-home satellite, which none of them were ever analog, or you were looking at the Intelsats over the ocean, which are circularly polarized. But most of the KU band satellites over the United States, they're all linear, so you need to tweak them.
Interesting. K6TPZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Hal.
W in the group K6TPC. Well, you guys mentioned variable levels. I was switching between omnidirectional and a beam by reverse polarity on the coaxial cable, feeding the DC voltage up, and at the other end, a diode in one direction for the positive, one direction for the negative, and I was able to reverse polarity, same voltage, to switch in either an omnidirectional antenna or a Yagi antenna with a feed. That's my little bit of information. You guys mentioned level changing. I did hard voltage changing. Go ahead.
By the way, the A2ATAS antennas work on a similar principle.
It just works on voltage levels, not reverse polarity, Eric.
It always done voltage up the cable.
No, they don't do reverse polarity. They do a control signal.
But reverse polarity is positive. When you reverse polarity, you're driving a relay coil to an RF isolation choke off of, you know, the coax. When you pull that relay, and you know you're either putting a negative on one relay, a positive on the other, putting a diode in series with the relay.
If a crafty ham is willing to put a network of diodes up at his relays on the top of the tower, and by way of a bias T, he feeds plus voltage, minus voltage, AC voltage, AC voltage at various frequencies, he feeds various voltages onto the semiconductor or coax cable along with the RF. He can do a whole lot of fairly sophisticated switching of relays and turning on pieces of electronics and whatever by nothing more than diodes and acoustic filters and so on up at the top. So the nice idea of feeding voltage up the coax cable is it's now rather well shielded. A lightning strike on that tower is much less likely to put a spike of voltage into your electronics than if you had a separate ribbon cable going up the tower controlling the electronics. That separate ribbon cable with various voltages on it to make that well shielded is nowhere near as easy as using the coax feed line itself, particularly if it's a double shielded piece of coax. It's a nice way of keeping an awful lot of things like lightning impulse voltages off of your electronics, or at least attenuating it a whole lot. So there's a whole art and science to doing that, as you're finding out, John, and I guarantee you've already used some of that. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, yeah, Dick, you're absolutely right. Steering diodes and some different voltages and reversing polarities, you can do an amazing thing, amazing things. So, yeah, I've done that, and it's bailed me out of a lot of problems. Not only for antennas, for other things, too. Let's see. I only had three questions this week, and the second question is actually a combination. Both are really asking the same thing, but let me let it drop, and I'll describe the situation. Alrighty. Last week, if you remember, we were talking about waveguide beyond cutoff, and this one gentleman has a question. As we go lower in frequency, we start to change that scissor action of the waveform traveling down the waveguide. As we lower, that bouncing becomes almost perpendicular between the walls, and it slows down the emanation of the wave. His question is, does that mean the reflection coefficient is going up on the input to that waveguide?
For the most part, the answer is no. The actual impedance the waveguide presents to your waveguide to coax adapter is relatively constant. If I used a piece of WR90 waveguide, for instance, a popular one that I've used a lot, that means there's 9/10 of an inch between the two narrow walls. That's why it's called WR90. WR stands for waveguide rectangular, that's the W and the R, and 90 means 9/10 of an inch. It is rated for 8.4 to 12.4 gigahertz. That's the desirable frequency region. And across that frequency region, the impedance seen by your waveguide to coax adapter, the thing that actually launches the signal into the waveguide, is relatively constant. I don't know the exact number, but if someone told me it's 350 ohms of impedance, I believe it's a fairly high number compared to coax cable. As I go to lower frequencies, if I look at the way the scissor bouncing waveform is going down, bouncing off the narrow walls, at 12.4 gigs, and I slowly slide the frequency down to 8.4 gigs, the scissors are opening up. The signal is bouncing at closer and closer to perpendicular to the walls. There's a very exact angle of each and every one of those bounces, depending on exactly what frequency you're sending down that waveguide. There's one and only one angle where all the signals bounces and reinforce each other, almost like resonance, but it's not resonance. Let me drop this. I mean, the scissor diagram gives you the equivalent of one of those bounces, but there's a zillion of those bounces going down that waveguide, and all those bounces have to add in a co-phase manner. as you go down to lower and lower frequencies, the WR90, I forget the exact number, but I think the true hard cutoff number is something like 6.8 gigahertz. As you go down to that lower frequency, the scissors open up wider and wider, the bounce becomes closer and closer to perpendicular to the wall, and just before you get to the cutoff frequency, yes, there is a very rapid change in apparent impedance, and right at cutoff, the waveguide is a short circuit. You cannot launch a signal in there. It acts like a short-circuited stub. You try to launch a signal into a piece of coax cable that's got a short at one end, all of it's going to reflect back to you. Well, the signal bounces back and forth between those two narrow walls when you're at the cutoff frequency and below, and it does not propagate forward at all. A little bit of signal leaks forward, but it's got a huge amount of attenuation. We might be talking about numbers like 50 decibels per foot. I don't know the exact number. And it might be 15 decibels per inch, some huge number. A little bit of the signal leaks through, but it's not really a waveguide propagation anymore. So at cutoff, it acts like a short circuit. Launching, let me drop it. No matter how you try to launch that signal at cutoff, the waveguide itself will look to you like a short circuit. Because it's a short circuit with a certain distance between the walls, you could call that short circuit highly inductive or highly reactive, but you can't launch real energy into it at the cutoff frequency and lower. No matter what you do, the signal just won't go there. The piston attenuator that's inside of your Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator is a piece of waveguide beyond cutoff. The signal going into the probe in that waveguide is really going into a quarter watt 51 ohm resistor, or maybe it's a 50 ohm resistor. So the signal you're launching into that piston attenuator, all of that signal is going into the 50 ohm resistor. A little bit of it leaks, and that's where the variable attenuation takes place as you move that piston up and down that piece of round waveguide in that particular case. If they didn't have the 50 ohm resistor there, your circuit that's driving the piston attenuator would be very unhappy. It would think it's driving a direct short circuit. And that also gives you a hint as to what goes on with that piston attenuator. Let me drop it. If you make the mistake of taking your Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, connected it up to your repeater, and your repeater is in full operation, and you slowly crank up the signal generator to find out where threshold is, and pretty soon you reach threshold, the receiver says, aha, I see a strong enough signal. You kill the carrier, you excite the carrier-operated relay, the repeater turns itself on, and 50 watts comes out of the repeater and goes roaring back into the Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator. It goes roaring back into a quarter watt resistor and vaporizes it instantaneously. You transmit a signal of more than a quarter of a watt back into a 608 signal generator, and you will do damage to that 51 ohm resistor that's in that output probe, and I think there's a similar one on the input probe that launches the signal down that piston attenuator assembly. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Oh, you're absolutely right. I had to replace one of those. Doesn't even look like a resistor. It's very special. And that was not easy to change. All right, let me go on to the second question on the same thing about waveguide. Let me let it drop. All right, this gentleman is asking, under these conditions, when we're at waveguide beyond cutoff and we still lower the frequency, do we concentrate the thermal, the temperature at that zone of reflection of those signals, do we concentrate that temperature more and more as that propagation gets less and less? Does that temperature go up higher, or does it stay basically uniform?
If I was using a piece of WR90 waveguide, and if I go to my program here, I'll do that in the beginning of, when I pass it back to you, I'll find out the exact cutoff frequency. Let's assume it was a cutoff frequency of 6.8 gigahertz, hard cutoff frequency. And I'm not feeding 6.8, I'm feeding 6.0. I'm well into the cutoff region. And I'm trying to feed a signal down that waveguide. And my method of launching that signal is I've got some kind of a probe that looks like a probe launching a signal. But that probe has a